City of North Las Vegas versus State of Nevada Local Government Employee Management Board.
I don't know how we all got to do this, but everybody.
Ready, council?
Yes, ma'am.
All right, come on up.
Chris Davis for the City of North Las Vegas. I'm happy to take this opportunity to appear before this honorable body, and I appreciate your attention. Let me go over some of the facts of this case, because I think that if you just listen to, you just read the EMRB brief, I'm not sure you actually understand what the facts of this case are. On July 11th, a complaint was made against Eric Spandauer for sexual harassing and stalking a female citizen during late night traffic stops. The City of North Las Vegas took this allegation very seriously, as I think you would expect we would. The department notified Spandauer that it had started an investigation and apprised him of his rights. At the end of the investigation, the department notified that they found that there was substantial basis for pursuing the complaint, and therefore notified Officer Spandauer that he had an investigation hearing when he could present his side of the story in order to convince the command staff that the allegations were untrue. Spandauer was placed on paid administrative leave pending the hearing. Sometime thereafter, a person in the EMRB hearing testified that Chief Parisi stated to Chief Parisi, "I understand that Eric Spandauer may have an issue with probationary status." And to which Chief Parisi allegedly said, "That is an option available to us." In another place, the POA president stated that Chief Parisi allegedly responded, "We believe that is an option available to us." Now, when you hear the EMRB and Spandauer talk about fraud, that's what they're talking about. That one statement. That's it. Okay? So they're talking about a statement about the chief saying that that's an option that may be available to us in the future. And so we're giving an opinion of something that hasn't even yet been determined. Instead of facing the mitigation hearing, Spandauer decided to resign. On November 7th, the Police Officers Association requested that the department print Spandauer to resign rather than go forward with the hearing and possible termination. After the association made its request, Chief Parisi indicated that before the hearing would be canceled, Spandauer needed to sign a settlement agreement. Spandauer was given a full opportunity to confirm with his union, with the union's attorneys, with anybody else he wanted to. And he signed the release and resigned on November 7th, 2005. In the settlement agreement, Spandauer specifically promised, and this is a quote, that he will not sue or make a claim against the City of North Las Vegas or the North Las Vegas Police Department. In exchange for the city's promise to close the IA investigation, if Spandauer chose to resign, and he still didn't even have to resign. If he did not resign, he could reschedule the IA interview, and Spandauer still had an opportunity to tell his side of the story. And that's what the EMRB calls, that I guess what they refer to as resignation being thrust upon him. And still a little confused exactly what that means, but we'll talk about that a little later. Spanbauer breached the settlement agreement, and that's undisputed, by filing an action with the ERB on June 1st, 2006, 25 days after the jurisdictional limitation had passed, that expired. The MRB then, without any factual legal support, found the SIMI discriminated against Spanbauer by not providing him with a mitigation hearing. If Spanbauer was, even though Spanbauer was the one who requested that he not be given the mitigation hearing, that he give him the opportunity to resign instead. I think out of those facts, in this scenario, that the MRB's order that City Committee's unfair labor practice just simply cannot be substantiated, either in fact or in law.
Mr. Davis, can I talk to you about the six-month time limitation here and the equitable tolling? Because in all these cases, you know, we got to look at our standard review, and we can't substitute our judgment for the MRB. So is that an issue of law, or is that a mixed issue of law and fact, since the board considered equitable tolling?
Well, it's an issue of law, and I can explain
why. Tell me why.
Okay. You know. This is probably a little far for you. It's a little far for me to read, okay?
Well, I can't read it, so you tell me.
Okay, can I come over here? Can you still hear? No,
that's okay. You can just tell me your point on that.
Okay. In NRS 288.110.4, which is the provision you're talking about, it's jurisdictional because it provides the EMR part of your complaint. The board may not consider any complaint or appeal filed more than 6 months after the occurrence, which is the subject matter of the complaint or the appeal. Okay? In other words, that is a limitation on the board's power. It specifically says it that way. It specifically enumerates it that way. And you as a body are bound by what the legislature decides. Now, you compare that with the NLR, then NLRA.
But what do we do with the equitable tolling doctrine?
Well, this court has already determined that if a statute is mandatory jurisdictional, there is no equitable tolling. It is strictly complied with, and there is no option available otherwise. For example, the NLRA says no complaint shall be heard upon any unfair labor practice occurring more than 6 months prior to the filing of the complaint. In other words, that's not a limitation on the NLRB to hear it. That's a limitation on filing the complaint. The same thing, for example, in that this court held with the employment discrimination statute, Nevada's employment discrimination statute. It's not a limitation on the court to hear the complaint. It says no action authorized by NRL shall be brought. Okay? Can you see the difference in the language? Okay? One of the first courts to ever consider the NLRB case, because the EMRB is, you know, asking this court to follow NLRB precedent on this issue. The reason, one of the first cases that decided was that the NLRA wasn't jurisdictional was in the Fifth Circuit, and that's in the Itasca case.
Counsel, was the statute of limitations question raised below before it went to the district court on the petition for judicial review?
Yes, it did, Your Honor. We, in fact, not only was it raised below, we raised it on a writ of mandamus before taking it to the EMRB.
So that's case concluding in your mind. 6 months is 6 months is 6 months.
6 months is 6 months is 6 months. Okay? But, okay, for the sake of argument, okay, say that equitable tolling was allowed. Okay? Say that instead of saying the board may not consider, it read exactly like the EMRB, the NLRA statute. If it read like that, say equitable tolling would be allowed, and we'd concede that, but it doesn't. But for the sake of argument, okay? Courts have unanimously considered, when they consider the issue, they have all talked about equitable tolling. And there is no, the only fact that they base equitable tolling on is supposedly Spanbauer discovered after the limitation period terminated, supposedly he discovered that some other employee was treated differently than he was treated. I'll get to why she wasn't treated differently a little bit later. But all the cases that talk about it say that wasn't grounds for equitable tolling. The statute of limitation begins to run upon the discovery of the adverse employment action. In this case, Spanbauer's resignation, he's alleging constructive discharge. I guess that's what the EMRB means by resignation was thrust upon him. I'm not clear certain because the EMRB has never cited case law in support of that statement, what that means. But every case, every court that has considered the issue has said you don't get equitable tolling for those grounds because that would just totally eviscerate the statute of limitations as it stands. The statute of limitations would be you could go on forever when you discovered it. When do you end? Do you end, okay, say you didn't discover it 25 days later. Say you discovered it 2 years later, 10 years later, 30 years later. When does that end? And that's why all the courts have said it's not, and in fact this court has even held, it's not when you know the legal effect of what's gone on with you. It's when you feel the initial adverse action. And that's in termination cases, that's upon termination. And our brief cites myriads of cases that state. I mean, I could go through cases of every jurisdiction, all the courts. If Your Honor wants me, or if you're familiar with the briefs, I won't do it. But we cite cases from almost every circuit in the United States. And they all hold that you do not get equitable tolling just because you discover later a discriminatory motive. And so that ends the question of equitable tolling, even if equitable tolling was available.
Counsel, did you want to reserve any time? You're at 5 minutes.
I'm at 5 minutes?
Yeah.
Let me talk about two things real quick, okay?
So is that a no or a yes?
Yes, I do. But let me talk about two things. Let's see if I can get through two things real quick. First of all, we have a settlement agreement. It bars it unless they prove the fact of fraudulent inducement. They don't even go through the elements of fraudulent inducement. And I refer to my brief to those elements and the arguments that go forward with that. Second of all, there is absolutely no evidence of any discrimination. This board has talked about how they're similar situated employees. Well, they're not similar situated. Every case says you can't compare somebody who resigned to somebody who doesn't. Every case says you can't compare on-duty conduct with off-duty conduct. There are cases that say that you have to have the same supervisor, same, a myriad of other things that have to be the same, and that's not the case here. So there wasn't any, first there was no adverse employment action because Van Bauer resigned. There was no, he was not treated differently. In fact, he was treated more favorably because he wasn't disciplined. And finally, even if he's made a prima facie case, it wouldn't matter because they haven't rebutted they haven't attempted to rebut our reasons for letting him resign because we let him resign because that's what he wanted to do. And so, Your Honors, I would reserve my last 3 minutes and 42 seconds if I could.
All right, thank you. Mr. Levine?
Yes, I will be presenting the argument on behalf of Ms. Bullock. It's my understanding that the EMRB's Deputy Attorney General is ceding me his time. Is that correct?
That's correct.
May it please the Justice, may I proceed?
Yes.
Thank you. May it please the Justices, Adam Levine on behalf of Eric Spanbauer. Counsel for the city spent a portion of his time arguing what he believes the facts of the case to be, or from the city's perspective. Very different facts were presented to the EMRB at a full evidentiary hearing, but the standard of review which governs this court precludes this court from substituting its judgment as to the weight of the evidence or the credibility of any witnesses, and your review is confined to whether or not the decision is arbitrary and capricious, which it clearly was not. Now, this is not an issue, just an issue of law. The issue of statute of limitations when a claim accrues is a mixed question of law and fact. It is very fact-intensive. And under the standard of review, where an agency's legal conclusions are closely related to their view of the facts, they are entitled to the same deference and are not to be disturbed as supported by substantial evidence. The EMRB, after a full evidentiary hearing, concluded and put in its findings that Eric Spanbauer did not know and could not have known of the discriminatory treatment that he was afforded by both his union and the department until April 6th. Now, I think the testimony was actually April 5th. The order says April 6th. Regardless, it doesn't make a difference. The express findings were he did not and could not know. Those findings were supported by substantial evidence and are entitled to deference by this court.
Counsel, why don't you walk us through the separation, not of the union, but as to the city of North Las Vegas, who is still before us. What did they do? What was their...
What did they do? Remember, Mr. Spanbauer was represented by his association. Therefore, any communications to Mr. Spanbauer had to go through the association. The department said to his representatives to have them communicate to Mr. Spanbauer, despite the fact that your 18 months is up, based on case law, which was false. There was no evidence of any case law actually presented. Based on case law we have, we can retroactively treat you as probationary and non-confirmed you. And if that's the case, you don't have a right to grieve. You don't have any rights at all. He was also...
So this was communicated by the city to the union representative.
To communicate to Mr. Spanbauer. The testimony was that President Smith of the association had multiple meetings with Chief of Police Mark Parisi, wherein the Spanbauer case was discussed. And Mr. Spanbauer was told, they can do this. If they do this, you have no right to grieve. You will not be represented. The only way, he was told, the only way you can save your law enforcement career is to resign so that the internal affairs file can't be accessed under what was called a privacy act, which is such thing.
Let's be real clear as we're talking about this. What was said by, quote, the union versus what was said by the city, because that's very important to us.
It is very important. However, when you are dealing with a breach of the duty of fair representation of this nature, it's a little beyond the scope of the briefing, but federal case law such as Baca v. Sy, Del Costello, always talks about where you have breaches of this nature, the actions of the employer and the union are inextricably interdependent. We can't know the origin of anything, whether it was the origin was with Chief of Police Parisi or Smith. We know that they talked about it, and we know this is what Mr. Spanbauer was told. And the representations which induced him to sign the release were false, regardless of whether it was by the Chief of Police or the union. The evidence was that they were acting together. Remember, if you discharge and disciplinary procedure is a subject of mandatory bargaining. You can't unilaterally impose a retroactive probation without engaging in collective bargaining. That is a clear violation by the city to make such a threat. The fact that the union breached its duty of fair representation and not stood up to the city and said, no, you can't do that, but basically told Spanbauer, this is what they say they're going to do. If they do this, you have no rights, you won't be represented, and the only way to save your law enforcement career is to sign this resignation here, which relieves the city of liability.
Looking at this statute, what is the occurrence that's referred to in 288.110.4?
The occurrence is obviously the prohibited practice, sex discrimination. Sex discrimination is defined as a prohibited practice under NRS 288.270, and I do want to address the subject of equitable tolling, because that's a very, very important issue. There is a presumption. Well, first and foremost, equitable tolling is available if that statute is a statute of limitations as opposed to a jurisdictional statute. In Cone versus Service Employees Union, footnote 2, this court cited with approval a Pennsylvania court decision which talked and used the discovery rule that a cause of action for a prohibited practice accrues when the affected person or entity knew or should have known about it. It was also, the statute was referred to by this court as a statute of limitations in Rosequist versus International Association of Firefighters.
The event that gave rise to his claim of sex discrimination, however, postdated his resignation by 4 or 5 months, correct?
It postdated. I don't know if it was a full 4 or 5 months. He did not learn about it.
Well, he resigned November 7th, and his female colleague who had the off-duty incident had that incident on December 30th, correct?
I believe that is correct. Okay.
So at what point, if that had happened 2 years after his resignation, would that give rise to an occurrence that would equitably toll this statute?
Equitable toll. The fact is, the answer is, I can't, is there's no way to know without looking at the specific facts of any individual case. Equitable tolling is a very fact-intensive...
Right, but I want to understand your argument. Would you say that 2 years, the same exact facts, but 2 years down the road, this woman police officer off duty has this incident, and he learns that she is, in his estimation, given a buy on it. Does that give rise to a new claim under this statute?
No, and here's, let me explain why. Because under Copeland versus Desert Inn, where this court adopted equitable tolling, it set forth the factors to look at. And one of the key factors is one, well, probably the most important factor is prejudice to the respondent employer. Obviously, the longer the period of time all the courts have held, the greater the prejudice. Now, equitable tolling cases from the Ninth Circuit have gone out as far as 1 year and recognized equitable tolling. But regardless of what the outside theoretical parameters are for equitable tolling, they're not implicated in this case. The case was filed a mere 24 days after the 6 months was up, or 25 days after the 6 months is up. While any number of hypotheticals can be construed and thought about, would this occur, would this be subject to equitable tolling? When you walk through the four factors set forth by this court in Copeland versus Desert Inn, the reasonable approach is no. Long-term subsequent events are not going to give rise to equitable tolling and allow a claim to be brought. But there is a very important point I'd like to make, Justice, which is that it's not just the sex discrimination which the EMRB found to be a prohibited practice. They also found a prohibited practice by the association and the city interfering with Spanbauer's rights to the bargain for grievance process. That is was a separate violation in addition to the sex discrimination. And obviously, Spanbauer could not have known about it on the date that resignation was thrust upon him because the union was complicit in the misrepresentations in inducing him to resign. It was only when he learned later, sitting in court with some of his former colleagues, and he saw his former representative, Chris Cannon, there, and he learned what happened, he went to Cannon, said, "Is this true?" And was told, "I think you better get a lawyer." And then he did proceed promptly. And one of the issues under equitable tolling is how diligent was the plaintiff after learning of the facts. And clearly, after learning of them, he very quickly went out, he got an attorney, John Tofano, and very promptly filed suit. So again, regardless of what the outside parameters are with regard to equitable tolling, it's simply not implicated in this case. Going back to the issue of the statute and the language of the statute, in the U.S. Supreme Court, in, I believe it was the Irwin case, stated that there is a presumption in favor of equitable tolling. Statutory language like this is insufficient to rebut that presumption, and the court, I believe the Montoya versus Chow case, said the only way to rebut the presumption in favor of equitable tolling is clear evidence in the legislative history, demonstrating that equitable tolling was to be unavailable. This court has consistently construed the Employee Management Relations Act in accordance with the National Labor Relations Act. The six-month statute is clearly patterned upon Section 10B of the National Labor Relations Act, which creates a six-month statute for filing a claim for a prohibited labor practice with the National Labor Relations Board. The federal courts and the NLRB have actually adopted a standard of clear and unequivocal notice. Now, again, in Cohn and Rosequist, and Cohn was decided in 2000, this court referred to the statute as a statute of limitations, which would make it presumptively applicable with equitable tolling. Case law has also recognized that when the legislature revisits an act after this court makes a decision and doesn't change a statute, there is a presumption that the legislature agrees. As far back again as 2000, this court in a footnote referred to it and, by implication, cited with approval other cases adopting the discovery rule for this statute. Chapter 288 was overhauled to some extent in the 2009 legislative session, where they imposed a brand new methodology for funding the EMRB, when the EMRB basically lost its funding. At no point when the legislature decided to revisit Chapter 288 did they amend the statute or take any action to suggest that equitable tolling or the discovery rule, which has been cited by this court, should not apply. And in light of that fact, equitable tolling should apply to this case. It is a mixed issue of law and fact to which this court must defer to the EMRB.
Counsel, you appropriately distinguish between the city and the police department's act of interference and then an act of discrimination. It would seem like the equitable tolling analysis should apply separately to each of those determinations.
Well, equitable tolling is based upon a misrepresentation, and the case law I cited says it doesn't even have to be an intentional misrepresentation.
Okay, let's stick with that point then. In finding 15, which seems to be the finding of the board to support the interference by the city of the rights of the confirmed police officer, I'm interested in your observation or comment as to where in those findings does it support a misrepresentation by the city that interfered in Spanbauer's right to proceed through the grievance process?
The reference comes in two separate paragraphs. They talk about the resignation being thrust upon him. While they did not detail the statements made which resulted in the resignation being thrust upon him, the two separate times it is referenced in this order is clearly the EMRB's reference to the underlying facts, wherein he was told the following statements again, that they can basically treat you as probationary even though your 18 months is up, that there is case law that allows them to do it, that you have no right. Those sorts of statements induced Spanbauer to resign because, in his own words, I have to rely upon my representative, or like soldiers in the trenches. As a matter of fact, the EMRB entered an express finding that Spanbauer's reliance was reasonable. And I think that Justice will go to the issue of where are the findings to support the interference with the rights of the grievance process, where you have resignation thrust upon him and an express finding that Spanbauer's reliance on that advice was reasonable, that would obviously trigger the equitable tolling.
Carrying my question then to one step further on the subject of equitable tolling, where in the findings does the EMRB identify the factual circumstances in which Spanbauer discovered this misrepresentation after the expiration of the filing deadline?
Actually, he learned before the expiration of the filing deadline. He learned on April 5th, which would have been shortly before. So let's be clear. He learned in open court on April 5th. The 6 months would have run on sometime after April 5th. In other words, I'd have to go back and do the do a quick calculation. He actually learned shortly before the statute ran, but equitable tolling tolls the statute and starts the 90 days at that time.
When I look at the findings, though, concerning statute of limitations on pages 13, 21, and 22 of the record, I don't find any finding, maybe I'm overlooking it, in which the EMRB makes the determination of his discovery on April 5th, as you argue.
I'm looking at, from the appendix, 1322,
mm-hmm.
paragraph 10, it was mm-hmm. not until April 6, 2006 that Spanbauer learned of the different treatment received by Officer Bueller for conduct which occurred while she was a probationary employee and that respondents had violated his rights.
Right, which is a finding that goes to the argument of discrimination. It is not a finding that goes to the contention of the misrepresentation concerning an interference in his rights.
Well, I think I may be over my time, but if I might respond to that, it is clearly implied because, remember, when he finds out of the differing treatment afforded to Officer Bueller, it necessarily shows or determines
so your
that he
argument.
Didn't get the same statement that you can be retroactively non-confirmed. The only way to save your career is to resign so that your records are sealed under this Privacy Act. If they go this route, you have no rights to grieve or appeal
so
or to be represented.
So the discovery of that misrepresentation is still rested upon the discovery of the disparate treatment to Bueller.
That's correct. Because remember, the testimony and the evidence was is that when he heard his fellow officers talk about it, he saw his former representative, Chris Cannon, and went and questioned Cannon. Hey, wait
right.
a second, you represented her, and his response was, you better get a lawyer. I believe I'm out of time. I will then refer to my brief on the issue of similarly situated. They were similarly situated, and there was no evidence presented, admissible evidence, testimony, that off-duty misconduct is to be treated differently.
All right, colleagues, any other questions? All right, thank you, Mr. Levine. Mr. Davis, I think you got a little bit over 3 minutes.
Let's see how fast I can go. When I was clerking for the Ninth Circuit, I worked for a very eminent jurist, Judge Robinson. And the thing that she said all the time when she was on the bench in your position was, show me in the record. I mean, Mr. Levine has made numerous allegations and been a very flamboyant man, but he never cites any petition in the record. There is nothing in the record that the City of North Las Vegas, any of its representatives, said anything to Mr. Spanbauer that would cause him not to say his rights. The only thing he said is, he was asked if there was an issue with probationary status, said that's an option available to us, or we believe that's an option available to us. That's the only evidence in the record.
Did anybody from the City of North Las Vegas testify at the hearing before the EMRB?
There were people that did that, but the person who made that statement supposedly was Chief Parisi, and he had resigned from his position earlier, took retirement.
But aren't you splitting hairs? The remark that he would not be treated, that he was able to be treated as a probationary employee, came from his representative, to be sure. Yet that remark was attributed to Chief Parisi, who was speaking for your client, the city, correct?
Right. But the thing is...
So your client was the origin of that remark. I think that's the point that Mr. Levine is making when he says that finding in paragraph 10 can fairly be attributed to the city as well as to the association.
I have no problem with that exact remark that was testified to is attributed to the city. I don't have any problems with that at all. The problem I have is... If that's a statement about a future possibility. It's a statement of, basically, it could be maybe construed as a legal opinion, but it is not a statement of fact which is required to state a claim of misrepresentation. If we're going to say, in our brief we cited a myriad of case law, that a person can't rely on the statements of law by another person because everybody needs to know what the law is for themselves. This is an issue of contract. In our brief, we cited numerous instances of contractual languages where somebody said, "Well, I did my interpretation of the contract," and it was totally didn't have any basis in the contract at all. And the courts have all said, even though it was totally not supported by the language in the contract, that's a statement of opinion, of a legal opinion, and not a statement of fact necessary to support a claim.
But aren't you asking us to judge credibility of what was presented before the MRB?
That's not an issue of credibility. That's an issue of law. Because we know what the statement is, okay? There's no dispute of what the statement was. That is in the record, okay? Now, the question is that statement, as a matter of law, a factual misrepresentation? And as a matter of law, it is not.
Why not?
Because this court itself has held that a statement of opinion is not... It's not a factual statement to support a claim for misrepresentation.
Mr. Davis, let me ask you one other thing. On the equitable tolling, you heard Mr. Levine's argument about the Desert Inn case and others, why we should apply, or equitable tolling should apply to this particular statute. Tell me why you disagree with that in the case law he cited.
The case law is the case of dealing with the second statute, which is, it says no action may be authorized, may be issued, brought. That says that you can't file a complaint. It's not a limitation on the court's power to hear it. Whereas this says the board may not consider This court itself said that kind of language is jurisdictional mandatory.
Okay. Well, they've also indicated, they pointed to Cone and I believe Rosequist, citing the opposite.
Well,
Rosequist
didn't deal with the issue. So any statement in the Supreme Court is just mere dicta. It didn't deal with the issue of whether or not this was mandatory or jurisdictional. And therefore, I'd say that this court is free to decide on its own. And what this court has always said, and contrary to Mr. Levine,
sure,
that you don't look at the legislative history if the statute is plain. And the legislator chose not to follow the NLRA, but decided to say the board may not. They decided to limit the board's jurisdiction.
All right. Colleagues, any other questions? Counsel, thank you for your arguments and the briefing on this. The matter will stand submitted. The court will stand in recess until the next call of the court at 11 or at 1:30.